The next case was presented by Dr. Dresner.
This is a retired nurse who presented at age 68 with a lump in her left breast. Biopsy showed a 2.2 centimeter grade 2 ductal carcinoma. Axillary dissection showed 2 of 12 nodes positive. Estrogen receptor was negative. HER2 was not overexpressed. Following this, she received 4 cycles of AC and 4 cycles of Taxol, a typical 3-week regimen. And following this, received radiation therapy to the breast. She remained well till about 2 years later, now at about age 70, when she complained of back pain for a month. Bone scan was positive at L1 and L3 and 2 left ribs. Biopsy of a rib was positive for adenocarcinoma. PET scan was positive in the same distribution as the bone scan with no other sites. Her CA27 was elevated to 78. Performance status at that point was 1. Treatment options were reviewed, and I decided to proceed with Taxotere on a 3 out of 4 week schedule. She was also started on Zometa. After 3 months of treatment, her back pain has improved. Her CA27 is down to 52, and she continues on that current therapy.
And again, how long was it from the time she completed her adjuvant chemo till the time she developed metastatic disease?
2 years.
2 years. Okay. So this case I thought was interesting in terms of the fact she'd had prior AC paclitaxel, and again, in patients like that, how do we make decisions? Where does bevacizumab fit in? Harold?
I think the data from Kathy Miller's presentation for ECOG 2100 directly relate to a patient such as this. She certainly would have met the eligibility criteria for this trial. And in that study, such patients were offered weekly paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab, and adding bevacizumab seemed to improve the major clinical endpoints of the study. The response rate went from around 14% to about 28%, and the time to progression went from 5 to 6 months up to about 11 months. And the toxicity seen with bevacizumab included those familiar for our oncologists who've already used it to treat colorectal cancer, things like hypertension, epistaxis of a low degree, and some minor degrees of proteinuria. So it seems like it encouraged tumor response and it helped prolong treatment time, and there was a suggestion that it might even have helped survival.
Before you go on, could you also comment on what the eligibility criteria were and specifically what kinds of patients weren't allowed into the study?
The eligibility criteria included women who had actually measurable or non-measurable disease, who were getting first-line chemotherapy, who had no evidence of brain metastases, and who might have received prior taxane therapy but could only have done so more than a year out, is my recollection. So, again, that does describe the case at hand, though we don't really know, for instance, how much benefit there is in women who've already had a taxane in the adjuvant setting. Those data were not presented separately at the meeting. I think that in a patient as described here, I would feel quite comfortable recommending a resumption of taxane, and I would use weekly paclitaxel because that's what was used in ECOG 2100 with bevacizumab. And we know that the patient is not a candidate for endocrine therapy. We know she's not a candidate for trastuzumab-based therapy. And so what we're left with is optimizing our chemotherapy tools. And so I think that trying paclitaxel with bevacizumab here is very reasonable. In the studies that were done previously looking at capecitabine plus or minus bevacizumab for women who had anthracycline and taxane-resistant breast cancer, it did not look like adding bevacizumab to capecitabine contributed substantial clinical gain in that setting. This patient sort of falls in between those trials. She wasn't really resistant to the taxane treatment. So whether capecitabine with bevacizumab would be a good choice for her or not isn't really clear to me.
I guess the other thing about the eligibility we should comment on is the fact that these people had CNS imaging and to rule out brain metastases.
Yeah, that's an important point. It's something we don't normally get in the routine evaluation of breast cancer patients early on, certainly in comparison to lung cancer patients where that's part of the initial staging workup. And so increasingly we are doing this now because we want to make sure patients do not have active CNS disease when starting bevacizumab.
Now, Dr. Dresner, can you kind of go back again to that point in time when you started the first-line therapy with docetaxel in terms of where the disease was and what her symptom state was and her state of mind?
Right. Well, at the time she recurred, she was very, very symptomatic. She had severe back pain, and I was actually concerned about a compression fracture, although that was really the L3 metastasis was where it localized to. There was really 2 vertebral bodies involved and 2 ribs, so it was not extensive bone. We discussed really options, which for several at that point, including oral Xeloda, which was not unreasonable as another choice, although she felt that she would prefer to hold an oral therapy for down the road if she would have trouble coming in on a regular basis. That was one of her concerns.
Interesting. How old was she again?
At this point in time, she was 70 years old, but still a very healthy 70 years old.
And what was her support network at home?
She was married, and her husband would come in frequently with her. She was much younger looking than 70 years old.
Chuck, how would you have thought through this situation?
I think that it would be a reasonable thought to use bevacizumab and paclitaxel. It should also be borne in mind that her adjuvant program included every 3-week paclitaxel. It's well known that even though you have this disease-free interval that would have been consistent with the protocol design, another reason to consider the weekly paclitaxel would be that you can get responses to the weekly in patients who have failed every 3 weeks. So I think that that combination would be a reasonable one among many combinations. So the first issue in dealing with first-line metastatic breast cancer is single agent versus combination therapy. And in general, I reserve combination chemotherapy for patients who have a lot more disease, who are significantly more symptomatic. And so I would agree with the choice of single agent therapy in this particular patient. From the standpoint of choice of single agents, while I am a major proponent of docetaxel in the adjuvant setting, I try to avoid docetaxel whenever possible in the metastatic disease setting because I really feel that the quality of life often achievable with that drug is not as good as you can get with alternative regimens such as weekly paclitaxel or Abraxane or Navalbine or single agent Doxil. So I found that the weekly docetaxel regimen actually may have even more toxicity than the every 3-week regimen. We see more epiphora. The two published studies of docetaxel, 25% of patients, each of the studies was about 30 patients in size, but with the weekly regimen, 25% of the patients went off study in both of those trials for toxicity, either epiphora, fluid retention, profound asthenia. So while arguably docetaxel is probably our single best drug, quality of life in the metastatic setting should predominate, and that's why I tend to use it later than other drugs.
For those people who do want to use docetaxel, how do you feel about the combination of docetaxel and bevacizumab?
Well, at the moment, I'm unaware. Certainly in breast cancer, there are no data. I don't know if there are data out there from the standpoint of giving toxicity information. I would prefer to have information. I know that Dr. Burstein has done a trial with vinorelbine and bevacizumab, so I think we do have a safety track record there. And as I said, I'm just unaware of safety data so far.
Hal, I know Sandy Swain has done some work, but I don't know if it's been published.
I don't think there's anything published. There's been a small study from NCI using preoperative docetaxel and bevacizumab, and Charlie Shapiro at Ohio State has done a phase 2 study in the metastatic setting. My sentiments, though, are similar to Chuck in that given the preponderance of data we have from weekly paclitaxel, I think that's the regimen of choice right now.
Getting back to you, Chuck, you know, before when you were talking about capecitabine as a common first-line therapy, I would think that in a patient like that, at least before ASCO, that would have been something that would have been pretty high up on the table. How do you now factor in bevacizumab in that kind of a situation?
I would consider this as one of a number of different therapeutic options, probably no better or no worse than many of the other therapeutic options that we have out there. If you look at the response rate for paclitaxel and bevacizumab in the measurable disease patients, I believe it was 35%. You can get first-line single-agent responses that are in the 35% range. If you're looking at other combinations, many of the combination regimens that we think about using may have response rates in the 50 to 60% range. So this was a very well-controlled, well-done study. I believe they had external response review that automatically reduces the response rate by at least 10%. At least it has in virtually every study where external response review has been given.
And it did in the capecitabine bevacizumab study, as a matter of fact.
Correct. And so consequently, I don't know that I would be wildly enthusiastic about this particular combination over any other particular combination or over single agent treatment. It's just one of the options that we have, and it's nice to have another option.
If you were going to use capecitabine first line, let's say that the interval from the paclitaxel was shorter and she got it dose dense or whatever, you decided you were going to give capecitabine first line, would you add in bevacizumab or consider adding it in?
Well, we certainly have toxicity data, and I wouldn't have a problem considering that as one of the therapeutic options, but we really don't have data. I guess the good news and the bad news is we have a plethora of conventional therapeutic options in the management of metastatic breast cancer, especially first line, and how you choose among these becomes a very complex issue.
Harold?
I'm a little more interested in the bevacizumab data, I think, than Chuck might be at this point. It is true that by using combination chemotherapy in different regimens, we've seen higher response rates and times to progression. I view this really as more of a conceptual trial. That is, you know, does this anti-VEGF strategy contribute something to breast cancer as it seems to in lung and colorectal? And in contrast to the previous negative result with capecitabine, I think we now do have data that this strategy has merit in advanced breast cancer. And so that opens up a lot of questions about who really benefits and how best to use it, and is it unique to the paclitaxel backbone, or is it unique to the line of therapy? Is it just treating patients who are less refractory, or all sorts of things? But I've been more inclined to use this regimen now as first-line treatment. And I must say I do so with some reservations, in part because of the cost, in part because I liked to use a lot of oral capecitabine in patients like this because it was so convenient, and it does have a very safe treatment side effect profile. But now, based on the ECOG 2100 data, I would offer a patient, as the one we've been discussing here, I would offer her the weekly paclitaxel plus bevacizumab program.
Chuck?
Yeah, I want to dispel the concept that I'm not actually really excited about bevacizumab. I am. And I was excited about it before 2100. And I was excited about it after the first line data came out, when there was a 7% response rate in patients who had far advanced breast cancer, heavily pretreated.
You're talking about as a single agent.
As a single agent.
Yeah, I know George Sledge and Kathy Miller talk about patients that obviously had useful clinical responses.
Well, there was a 30% clinical benefit rate. And so when that study came out, the analogy is Baselga's original publication on Herceptin, where the overall response rate in heavily pretreated patients was 11%. And so I felt that bevacizumab was going to be an active drug. And then when the major capecitabine study came out, I was actually encouraged by the improvement in response rate, even though the primary endpoint of time to progression was not met. So all along, I've had a feeling that bevacizumab was going to become an active agent in breast cancer. And where I'm struggling at the moment is trying to figure out exactly where to use it. And I guess once I start to use it, and if I start to use it up front where it is recommended and I start to see exciting responses, maybe I'll get even more excited in terms of its overall place within the spectrum of treatments for metastatic breast cancer.
And it's interesting, one of the most common comments we get from listeners is they feel reassured when they hear clinical investigators struggling, because they feel like it's not just them. It, you know, people are very, very focused on these data, still kind of having a hard time figuring out what it means.